I once came across a saying that went, "The biggest dreams are found and made on the streets of Los Angeles." I used to obsess over this quote in my early 20s as I'd convinced myself that the only way I'd ever achieve my dreams was if I moved to Los Angeles. My obsession with the city of dreams continued to grow over time, and it wasn't long before I eventually caved and moved there to chase my big dreams. Everything was fine at first, but unfortunately, I soon realized how wrong I was, as the only thing I found in LA were horrific nightmares. The tragic tale you're about to hear will explain why. I moved to the city of Los Angeles when I was 23 years old. I can still remember every single detail of that day, as I thought moving there would be the start of a beautiful time in my life. I lived with my childhood friend, a girl named Vicky, and we would always stay up all night talking about our dreams and the things we wanted to accomplish in the city. Vicky was a proper LA girl, as she moved there when she was 9 after her father had gotten a job opportunity in the city. Our mothers were best friends, and we pretty much grew up together as we'd known each other since we were 2. We'd managed to keep in contact over the years, even after she moved, and I remember how ecstatic Vicky was when I told her that I was planning on moving to LA. My first few months in LA went pretty well, as Vicky really helped me to quickly settle in, having lived there for most of her life. I really don't know how I would have survived without her, as she'd integrated me into her friend group and even showed me all the best places to eat and shop. After living with Vicky for a while, I realized that she was pretty well known around her area, as the locals had given her the nickname, the Party Queen. She'd told me that she'd gotten this nickname because she always managed to get invites to the best parties in LA. Her nickname didn't come as a surprise to me, as Vicky loved to party and live her life to the fullest ever since we were little. She also used these parties as a tool to grow her social connections, as Vicky wanted to be an actress when she finished school, and she knew the people she met and the connections she made during these parties could help her achieve her dream of acting. Vicky often took me along whenever she needed a plus one to the parties she'd gotten invited to. I experienced some of the best moments of my life at the LA parties that I attended with Vicky, as we'd always had a great time together. However, while I didn't know it at the time, the parties that I loved going to would eventually lead me to a horrific experience that would scar me for life, and it all began when Vicky managed to get invited to one of the most exclusive parties in Hollywood. I can still recall the excitement on Vicky's face that fateful morning when she told me about the invite. She said she'd moved heaven and earth to get us into the best and most exclusive party of the year. I asked who was hosting the party, and Vicky looked at me with a wide grin on her face as she said the name, Mr. Combs. I was speechless at first, as I couldn't believe the words that had just come out of her mouth. The reputation of these infamous parties hosted by Mr. Sean Combs, who's popularly known as Puff Daddy, preceded them, as everyone knew they were some of the wildest parties ever thrown in LA and across the United States. I didn't know how she got an invite, as it was nearly impossible to get one. But Vicky said it was a friend of a friend who worked for him that managed to get her in. After the excitement of being invited had simmered down, we spent the whole day getting ready for the party that night. I can still recall the smile on Vicky's face as she said, "This is going to be one of the best nights of our lives, and I'm sure it's going to be a Hollywood story that we'll remember forever." The party was held at Mr. Combs' Los Angeles mansion, which was located in the Homely Hills neighborhood on South Mapleton Drive. It started at 9:30 p.m., but Vicky and I had arrived at 10:30 p.m. Before we were allowed to enter, the man at the door told us to hand over our phones, as the taking of any photos or videos without Mr. Combs' consent was prohibited. I didn't see anything wrong with this, as I assumed it was due to the alarming amount of high-profile guests and A-list celebrities that were attending. After we'd given them our phones, we were then given a piece of paper to sign. I didn't know what it was at first, but I soon realized that it was a non-disclosure agreement. Vicky quickly signed hers and asked me to sign mine so we could get inside, but I was a bit hesitant. There were certain details of the NDA that I found strange, particularly the one that said the NDA was in effect for the entire life of the signee plus 20 years after their death. I wondered what could be going on behind those doors that we couldn't talk about for the rest of our lives. I started getting nervous, but Vicky calmed me down, saying that this was just the standard at these types of parties. I knew we couldn't turn back now, and I also knew how hard it was for Vicky to get us invited, so I didn't want to ruin the night for her. The man at the door was already giving me a strange look, and I knew I didn't have much time left to make up my mind. So I put all my fears aside and convinced myself to sign it. Once we signed, we were quickly ushered into the lavish mansion. It all felt surreal, and I couldn't believe I'd made it to a Diddy party after just a few months of living in LA. Only a few minutes had passed before I finally saw Mr. Combs. He walked up to us, and after we exchanged pleasantries, he told us that we weren't meant to be partying with anyone else in the main room, as we were special guests and we were supposed to be in the VIP room. I was confused as I wondered what he meant by special guests. That's when he took us to a secluded room in the mansion, and as he opened the door to usher us in, my heart dropped to my stomach. The room we were told to enter was some sort of BDSM-themed sex dungeon. My mind couldn't handle it all, as some of the most vile, sadistic, and masochistic sexual acts were being performed in every corner of the room. I saw several women hanging naked from the ceiling. Some of them had needles sticking out of their bodies, while others were bleeding while participating in sexual acts. I'd heard about hematoglycinia, or blood play, which is a fetish where people are sexually aroused by blood, but I'd never seen it carried out before, and it horrified me. This was just a fraction of what was going on in that room. The more I look, the worse it got. Several people around the room were participating in even more disturbing sexual acts like scat play, which involved the use of feces, extreme sexual asphyxiation, and electrostimulation, just to name a few. I can't even properly describe some of the extreme scenes I witnessed in that room, as they are far too graphic to repeat. I recognized some of the male and female celebrities who were participating in these extreme sexual acts. There were some of the biggest stars in Hollywood there, but I can't bring myself to mention any of their names. After showing us around, Mr. Combs then proceeded to coerce both me and Vicky to participate in these disturbing sexual acts with several other women. We wanted to leave at that point, but we soon realized that we wouldn't be able to, as Mr. Combs and a few of his celebrity friends were very coercive, and I knew they weren't going to stop until they'd managed to convince us. I remember how Mr. Combs, his eyes bloodshot red from all the drinking, coerced Vicky into participating by saying,
Nah, playgirl, we just getting started, and we won't stop, can't stop. Come on, baby, this is your key into Hollywood, and I know you're not stupid enough to give this up. You don't want to leave now?
This was probably the worst mistake of our lives, but we were young and eventually caved under the pressure. Just like the many other women there, we allowed Mr. Combs and his celebrity friends to have their way with us. I don't know how long it all lasted, but right when I thought it was over, things got much worse. Mr. Combs said he'd saved the best part of the night for last, as he informed everyone that we were about to carry out an exclusive Diddy Party BDSM act called the Pinata. The Pinata was apparently an extreme form of BDSM spanking or impact play. The men were given wooden bats padded with cotton, and a woman who was tied up was then placed in a circle while Combs and his friends violently whacked her around the room using the padded bats as if she were a pinata. They'd managed to get several women to participate in this disturbing act, and unfortunately, one of them was Vicky. Vicky hadn't realized what she'd signed up for, and I can still remember the terror in her eyes when it started. She eventually began to scream, saying she didn't want to do it anymore, but Combs and his friends didn't care.
Dance, bitch, and sing
the
song.
All just kept hitting her around the room.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. Who got the Johnson & Johnson?
It wasn't long before she couldn't take it anymore, and I watched in horror as Vicky collapsed. I rushed to her side and noticed she wasn't moving. Mr. Combs then told everyone to clear the room, saying he would get her some help. I can never forget how excruciatingly bad I felt as Vicky's motionless body was then taken out through the back because Mr. Combs didn't want to alarm the guests partying upstairs. I tried to go with her as I didn't want to leave her side, but Mr. Combs didn't allow it. He told me he would handle it personally and assured me that Vicky would reach out to me the next day when she was feeling better. But unfortunately, that was the last time I ever saw Vicky alive. When I didn't hear from Vicky the next day, I endlessly tried reaching out to Mr. Combs to find out what happened to my friend, but he never gave me a straightforward answer. Not long after, Vicky's family started calling and asking about her whereabouts. At this point, I told Mr. Combs that I'd have to tell her family and the police the truth, but he reminded me of the NDA I signed and threatened me with violence and imprisonment for defamation if I ever talked. Mr. Combs told me to tell Vicky's family that she'd run away and skipped town, or else the same thing that happened to her would happen to me. Lying to Vicky's family was the worst thing I'd ever done in my life. But I was completely terrified and knew I had no choice. Vicky's family eventually reported her as a missing person when they never heard back from her. But despite several efforts from the authorities, the police were never able to find her. The story you just heard was anonymously shared by a woman using the alias Catherine. Numerous efforts made by the authorities to uncover the woman's real identity and to verify these claims have proved fruitless, as there was no possible way of tracing the tragic story back to her. With the many recent atrocities that have surfaced against Mr. Sean John Combs, widely known as Puff Daddy or P. Diddy, the authorities are currently trying to uncover the entire truth behind the unspeakable acts that took place at Mr. Combs' freak-off parties, in addition to his white parties. Investigators believe they have only just scratched the surface of the horrors Mr. Combs committed at these events, and they hope to bring justice to all affected parties at the end of the investigation. The date was May 2nd, 1965, and I just graduated from high school a few months before the incident happened. I'd taken a job at our local movie theater, hoping to save some money before heading to college, and finally leaving my small religious hometown of Gideon Hollow. At the time, movie theaters were very different from how they are today, as there was a lot of censorship and scrutiny over which films could be shown, especially in a town like ours. Most weeks we had the same four movies in rotation, keeping things predictable and, quite frankly, boring for anyone who hadn't started a family, as there were typically sci-fi, religious, or adventure movies we had seen a million times. One day, as I went to grab the next reel from storage for the midnight showing, something caught my eye. I noticed a dusty old film canister half buried under the low shelf where we kept the reels. I wiped off the dust before staring at it for a while, and when I finally realized what it was, I felt an odd mix of excitement and confusion, as I couldn't understand how a horror movie had ended up in our theater in the first place, let alone stayed hidden all this time. To be honest, those questions didn't really matter to me, and all I could think about was how my friends and I had always wanted to see a real horror movie, and how unbelievably lucky we were that one had been sitting under our noses all that time. The next day, I told my friends to meet me at the theater after the midnight showing, and when the four of them arrived, I finally showed them the reason for my invitation. The excitement was written all over their faces as I pulled out the reel from under the counter. The time was around 1:15 a.m. when we moved into the empty showing room, and after setting everything up and turning off the lights, we all sat down in the front row, eyes glued to the screen as the movie title faded in slowly. The Forsaken Ones. The movie started off like any other, with a cast of six friends, three boys and three girls who lived in a small religious town not too different from Gideon Hollow. As we got further into the movie, though, things started to seem less normal as I began to notice strange and unsettling similarities between the movie characters and my friends. At first, I kept it to myself, thinking I was just overanalyzing things as usual. In all fairness, the names and appearances were different enough, but little factors remained the same in their lives. The way they spoke, acted, and even the clothes they wore all seemed a little too familiar. For starters, the movie character Matt, as they both had two adoptive parents, loved skating and were always getting in trouble. The only difference was, in the movie, Matt was a straight-A student who basically lived for school, and that couldn't have been further from the truth in reality. Then there was Julia, the athlete of the group, who reminded me of Mariana in the sense that they were both regular participants in the swimming team. Except Mariana wasn't that great of a swimmer, but Julia was, and wasn't only a swimmer, but also ran track, played volleyball, soccer, and had multiple college offers from all over the country. Zach's counterpart was a character named Malik, and just like Zach, he was always getting high and smoking anything he could get his hands on, but with one key difference. Malik was Muslim, and Zach was about as far from religious as you could get. My friend Jane was your typical girl next door, with two loving parents and top grades in school. While that all remained true in her character, Cleo only got good grades by cheating and hooking up with other students to help her with homework. Beyond the characters, something about the town and the movie struck me as oddly familiar, like deja vu. The streets and the regular spots all felt like places I was familiar with, almost like I'd been there before. With all that being said, at the time, I didn't actually believe there was any correlation between the movie and our lives in the real world. Not just because it seemed extremely far-fetched to me, But because the whole movie was centered around one character who didn't seem to remind me of anyone I'd ever met. Caroline. Caroline's story was the first glimpse of actual horror we had seen in the movie. But to be honest, her story seemed more tragic than terrifying. Caroline, like the rest of them, was a teenager living in a small, deeply religious town, and the movie plot revolved around how she and her family moved to the town, hoping to escape their dark past. It was there she met the rest of the cast, and as the movie went on, Caroline's secret was revealed, showing that her parents had been accused of practicing witchcraft and committing ritualistic crimes in their previous town. After laying low for some time and starting a new life in the town, her family thought they'd left their past behind. But word traveled fast about their crimes, and it didn't take long before Caroline's supposed friends, starting with Cleo and her parents, turned her into the community. After that, it wasn't long until the whole town went after them, eventually hunting them down and taking them into the woods to be judged and buried alive. This all happened about halfway through the movie, and from then on, it spiraled into a series of gruesome and tragic deaths, with each supporting character suffering a horrific death as punishment for their betrayal of Caroline and her family. It started with Matt as he skated home from school one day before hitting a rock on the floor, falling, and shattering his skull on the pavement beside him. Pieces of his brain were all over the floor, and the blood and general gore were more shockingly detailed than I'd ever seen, looking more realistic than in modern movies today. Next was Julia, and the scene started with her and the rest of her teammates at swimming practice. The coach blew for them to go, and Julia jumped into the water but twisted her ankle in the process. She screamed for help and fell slowly underwater, but the coach and team simply gathered around and watched as she struggled to breathe until her lungs filled with water and her lifeless body floated back to the top of the pool. This trend continued slowly, and every scene seemed longer and more disturbing than the last. Each one went on for a while, with every bit of gore and suffering so detailed that my stomach began to turn. The Zach character was home alone the night of his friend's death, and after forgetting to put a cigarette in the kitchen, it somehow reacted to a gas leak and exploded. The horrific death scene started with Zach letting out a gut-wrenching scream before staggering outside with his body engulfed in flames and dropping to his knees, dying on the driveway. There was about a 5-minute scene of his burning body lying on the pavement and coughing up blood before eventually dying. After that was Cleo's scene, the first to betray. She got stabbed on her way home after school by a group of men who eventually spent the next 10 minutes of the movie using and mutilating her body before tossing her into the same woods where Caroline was buried. The Cleo scene was the most I could handle that night, and I quickly got up feeling nauseated and needing to throw up. My friends began to laugh as I got up to leave, but out of the corner of my eye, I could have swore I saw someone sitting all the way in the final row of the theater watching the movie with the rest of us. I turned to check, but no one else seemed to notice. Everyone just assumed I was trying to scare them, but I just couldn't shake the feeling that someone or something else was in that theater with us. Honestly, aside from the brief image I got of her, there wasn't any actual proof that someone was there. So I ended up blaming it all on my paranoia before leaving the room and heading toward the bathroom. I stayed there for about 25 minutes, and by the time I returned to the theater, the movie was over and all my friends were getting up to leave. It all seemed to have worked out perfectly for them, as they couldn't stop talking about how insane it was and how I was the only one who would actually get scared by a movie. The truth is, it all felt extremely normal as we walked toward the exit, but just as we were about to leave, John tripped on one of the steps, slammed against a row of chairs hard, and burst his head open on the theater floor. The sound of the impact echoed as a pool of blood slowly formed around his head shortly after. We stood still, completely frozen in shock by what had just happened in front of us. After some time, we slowly began approaching the body to check if he was alive. But as we walked towards it, Mariana suddenly got an uncomfortable look on her face, and I watched as she clutched her throat, suddenly struggling to breathe. The rest of us rushed towards her, visibly confused by what was happening and trying to help. Just like in the movie, she started coughing up a lot of water, choking and gasping for air, almost like she was drowning on dry land and there was nothing we could do. Eventually, she choked to death on the water she was coughing up and collapsed lifeless, leaving us paralyzed with horror as reality blurred with what we had just seen on screen. My mind raced as I realized what was happening to my friends, but before I could fully process it, almost on cue to confirm my suspicions, the room filled with a loud crackly noise, followed immediately by a sudden wave of heat as Zach burst into flames behind me. Jane and I quickly stepped back as his screams filled the room, and after running around for a few seconds, his body dropped to the floor, twitching in pain. My heart pounded as I turned to Jane in horror, anticipating what might come next, but she didn't seem to be in her right mind at that point. She simply continued to cry with a devastated look on her face, distant with empty eyes as if she was beyond fear, somewhere between shock and disbelief. It was like her mind couldn't process the gruesome reality unfolding before us. Her eyes darted across the room and her body trembled in fear. I knew what was coming for her and me, but I didn't have the heart to stay and see it happen. Without a word, I got up slowly before bolting out of the theater and into the cold street. I ran down into the darkness without any hope, half expecting some cursed fate to kill me before I got too far. But all I remember was running and running until I was eventually at home, sitting on my bed and exhausted as I tried to wrap my mind around what had happened that night. Somehow I had survived, and to this day, while I may have my theories and ideas, the truth is I still have absolutely no clue how I was able to escape the theater that night. The nights that followed were haunted by images I couldn't shake even after years of therapy. The looks on my friends' faces as they died in agony played over in my head for years, and the eerie flickers from the theater screen burned into my mind. I could hardly get any sleep, and when I did, I'd wake up drenched in sweat with my heart racing from the nightmares. The police called off their investigation in about a month, as the deaths were so random and confusing that they didn't know where to begin asking questions. I could relate in that sense, as I still have about a billion questions about that night, the theater, and Caroline's story in Gideon's Hollow. Personally, I believed our town was cursed the second Caroline and her family were executed in the woods, but I'm still not sure if Caroline's story was even real to begin with. Maybe we just weren't meant to watch the movie at all. All I know is that I'd probably escaped my horrific fate the second I got up to use the bathroom and missed my character's death scene. I left Gideon's Hollow later that year, after a long time in therapy. But the town didn't stay the same for long. They said it was just changing times, but the heart of that place seemed to rot from within, slowly slipping into ghost town status. People left, houses boarded up. One by one, the theater and every bit of Gideon's Hollow history faded until it was like our town had vanished off the map. And sometimes I think that maybe the town, the movie, and the theater should have all been buried a long time ago.